Hi, I'm Jenny Castro, and this is Holding It Together. Too often in the context of faith and lived experience, the stories we tell are stories of overcoming and success, of dreams fulfilled. In 2018, Mennonite Church USA's Women in Leadership Project has teamed up with the Mennonite Inc. to produce a podcast featuring stories of people in progress. We're noticing the beauty of the process. We'll paint pictures of authentic and whole people. Here, we recognize that we need one another to hold together with us all that we carry in our journey of becoming and bear witness to it. Because yes, some days we do shine, but most days we're just holding it together. Holding It Together works like this. For each series, we choose a theme and explore that theme from all different angles over the course of about 5 episodes. Our theme for this series is Women in Leadership. Over the course of the next few episodes, we'll get to know women who've been called to leadership. We'll explore the questions they encounter regularly and talk about the challenges they face every day. We will hold their stories and celebrate the movement of the Spirit through them in the world. Today, we bring you a discussion among 3 generations of women in leadership in Mennonite Church USA. Allison Brookins says she's trying to live into the titles of pastor, pester, and playwright. She serves in her first-time pastor at Chicago Community Mennonite Church, organizes with the Dismantling the Doctrine of Discovery Coalition, and moonlights as a playwright with TED and Company Theater Works in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Melinda Elizabeth Berry lives with her family in Elkhart, Indiana, where she is assistant professor of theology and ethics at Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary. Melinda and her spouse, John Stolzfus, are members of Fellowship of Hope Mennonite Church. And finally, we have Gail Gerber-Kutz. She is Professor Emerita of Theology and Ethics at Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary in Elkhart, Indiana, after teaching for more than 30 years there. Currently, she's doing various kinds of volunteer work in Goshen, Indiana, and Tucson, Arizona. She's also nurturing friendships and engaging in family life with her 5 children and 4 grandchildren. Allison, you're new to the pastorate.
What?
Yeah, tell us about some of the challenges you have encountered in your journey towards pastoral leadership.
I'm in a very remarkable church to be a first-time pastor. They see it as part of their calling to train new pastors, so they're very open to me being new, and they're incredibly supportive of me. One of the things that I didn't really expect to be quite such a big thing or to be as rankling to me as it is people who are outside of my congregation. Like, no one in my congregation has done this, let me just be clear. But people outside my congregation in other churches or not in a church who are shocked when they find out I'm a pastor. And the way that they express that shock is either, but you're so young, or wait, how old are you? I get it. I get that I look really young. It's also just become incredibly obnoxious that is people's reaction. So I spent some time thinking about my response to that. And for a while, I would just say, oh, I'm old enough, which is true. But now if someone says, you're so young, I just say, oh, well, I was born again. So finding these ways to make it humorous and turn the conversation away because
it's a great line, Allison.
And I also have found myself dressing more professionally than I ever have before and than I ever thought I would. And it's a lot less about what other people are telling me to do and a lot more like I feel like I have authority, not in a like authority over, but I feel strong when I dress in certain more professional ways. Yeah, so that's been an interesting journey that I imagine will be ongoing until my gray hairs really start coming in.
Melinda, I'd be interested in your response to the question Jenny asked Allison. What kind of obstacles have you faced?
I wouldn't say that it's been an obstacle exactly, but anytime I've been ever asked to reflect on mentoring, I've had to sit with the reality that most of my mentors have been men, simply also because most of my professors have been men. And there's a certain kind of sadness I have with that. I mean, I'm delighted to be here with you, Gail, who was one of my teachers and one of my mentors, and Allison, who's been my student. So this is the first time I've ever been in a conversation where, you know, we have this sort of three generations of women in leadership in the Mennonite Church. But I think the sense that we have to kind of find our own way, forge our own path, has led to me feeling a certain inner strength and inner power that Allison was describing that's been really valuable in my life. But at the same time, I would say the sense that when I was hitting internal walls through my doctoral process, there was a sense I've got to figure out how to pick myself up by my own bootstraps, figure this out, forge my way. And when it comes to negotiating, the work that I had done negotiating relationships in my family system, for example, didn't necessarily prepare me very well to negotiate in employment settings. So struggling with this sense that I should be grateful, or that I feel grateful. It wasn't that I was supposed to be grateful, but I felt grateful for every opportunity that I had been given. And so that I needed to work hard to prove that I deserved it and I wasn't going to let down the team. I would also say, though, too, that patriarchy likes to show up every once in a while. And so there have been other times when some of the obstacles I've faced in kind of stepping into leadership roles maybe come from the subtle messages that people don't say out loud in most of the circles I travel in, but start to show up maybe, we might say, more passive aggressively through little bits of resistance. There isn't a clear example that comes to mind, but I would maybe say things like the ways that women are expected to collaborate rather than kind of stepping up and allowed to be in charge in a group setting.
Gail, how about you? What are the obstacles you faced in your journey as a woman who is a leader in the Mennonite Church?
I would really agree with you, Melinda. Our experiences probably aren't that different in terms of men being primary mentors. Although when I thought about it, I would say that Anna Yunke, who is a college professor, was an important female role model in leadership for me. She was very smart, very confident, and competent. And I didn't have that many female models. If I think about obstacles in my generation, one was just lack of a vision of what might be. I never really considered being anything other than a teacher or a nurse, and I knew I didn't want to be a nurse, so that left teaching. And I'm glad because I love teaching, but that's a pretty limited sort of range of vision. I just didn't know that women who did very many other things. Mm-hmm. So at least Anna was a college professor and a good one. So that was important.
As human beings, we get to be conscious and awake to systems. But we also know the importance of more intimate friendships and relationships that we have with individual people. And so I often like talking about the cross as a symbol of this intersection between the system and the interpersonal. That somehow being human means, yeah, I understand how power works, but I also know that in this moment or in this series of important decisions or crossroads that I was at, I needed someone to help direct me. And it just so happens that the people who helped give me direction were men. And I'm also a strong Christian feminist, right? So what do I do with that? I just recognize that this is one of the paradoxes of being human.
Patriarchy has affected Christianity and Mennonites, and it has affected the potential for women to be leaders in the church and, you know, in our culture. Where do you see patriarchy sneaking in, and where can we begin to say, no, we're not going to do this? This is kind of about personal change and interaction, but also like systemic, like the two things. We operate and live in these two levels.
Yeah, I have a little bit of a story that I think fits in with this, with how things sneak in and they're big and systemic, but they wear the clothes of something very small.
Yes.
And the example is the podium at my church. And this podium was designed and built by a woodworker and artist who used to be a member of my church and who has also created our altar and our cross. It was very short when it was first built. It was too short. They added like a 4-inch board to the bottom of it, lifting it up. I arrive, I'm 5'3" and a half on a good day, and it's too tall for me. I can use it, but my hands, instead of being like, I can like grab the edges and feel like I'm able to speak over the podium to the people and able to like be in a place that feels strong and good to me. No. My hands are up like closer to my shoulders. A few women in my church who are very good scripture readers who are both at best 5 foot, and it's like up to their chin. For me, this is so much not about this podium. It's not solely about me. It's about this being a hospitable place for people of all heights. I would like it to be shorter for a person who uses a wheelchair. I'd like it to be tall enough for the 6'6" people in our congregation. And then I talked to the artist and he said, yeah, that was one of the very first pieces that I made. I was never very happy with it. I'd be happy to replace it. We're working with him to design a new piece that would have a foot lever and that would be fully adjustable all the way up for very tall and people who needed to sit while they read. So creating out of my need, out of my particular need, which is I'm the main preacher and I need a podium that works for me, we're creating something that can be hospitable to a lot more people. And I think that that maybe is a good metaphor for women in leadership in general, is that, oh, my individual particularity as a woman, I need this thing, but I'm going to not just make it good for me, I'm going to make it good for everybody. I think that that is more common with women in leadership. That's why I would say that we need more women in leadership, is more people attending to the particularity of a wider range.
Well, yeah, and Allison, part of what you're describing is a power with rather than a power over, as well as a sense that patriarchy is not just about making life rough for women. Patriarchy makes life rough for everybody. I think that that's something that it's just really easy for us to lose sight of, because it is so focused on there's a limited amount of power. You've got to get whatever piece of it you possibly can, hold on to it. I think we see this a lot when we shift from talking about interactions between men and women or among men and women to conversations about race and ethnicity. That sort of mindset that there is a pie and everybody's got to try to figure out how to get as big a slice as they possibly can and keep as much of it for themselves and their community and not share it with anybody else. That just becomes a zero-sum game.
Well, it's a worldview of scarcity, right? It's like, yeah, I need to protect what is mine rather than believing that there is enough for everyone and creating systems in which there is enough for everyone.
I'm less interested, or not as interested as I used to be, in talking about patriarchy. I'm more interested in, well, first of all, I've seen a huge change, including in MCUSA in my lifetime, beginning with hardly any women at all in leadership, in church institutions, and in congregations. And now there's, you know, significant women in leadership. So that's, that to me, doesn't mean that things are great or perfect by any means. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep working at it. But I guess I'm more interested in what can we do to keep from losing what has already happened? What can we do to continue to nurture young women? What can we do to work at mutual and collaborative leadership? How can we be creative? There's an important role in saying no in any kind of revolutionary movement, which is really what Christian feminism is. But when I think of where we were when I started graduate school, I read every single book just about, I think, that had been written on Christian feminism at that point. And now, you know, I don't have an idea of what all is out there. It's just impossible. There's been huge developments in biblical studies and theological studies and leadership work. There's a part of me that wants to say, well, can't we celebrate a little bit now and then? Can we find some of those stories of mutuality between women and men? How do we live with the pain of patriarchy and name it and resist it, and at the same time find some joy in what God has been doing indeed in some transforming work?
I'm, again, in that kind of in-between space. When I had my first sort of official teaching gig at Goshen College, I was shocked to discover that first-year students were running around talking about themselves as freshmen. Now, okay, you know, that's a small thing, but a big part of my educational experience coming to Goshen College was the formation of an inclusive language, both at the policy level, but as a worldview, to say, no, we're first-year students, second-year students, third-year students, fourth-year students, to raise this issue with people who'd been my professors who hadn't even realized the drifting back into old language.
I am always amazingly astounded by the shoulders I'm standing on. I feel like the first time this really hit home was when I attended the lament and apology services that AMBS held in my first year at seminary. I think I wasn't really supposed to be there, but I ended up being at the service where women were sharing their stories. And then I was in the service of lament and the service of apology. So this was like 2 days that I was encountering these stories, and then seeing my female president and dean standing up there leading this incredible worship service and apology service, that was very formative for me to see, like Gail said, how much has changed and how far things have gone. Because I think I grew up very privileged and very able to forget quite how hard or how bad things have been for women. I am trying here to acknowledge what Gail was talking about, of how much progress there has been. I want to mention someone who's been an important mentor and a friend. Her name is Irene. I met her in Madison. We were students together. She was a grad student while I was finishing undergrad. And I went one day to her volunteer organization, which was a Books to Prisoners that served LGBTQ prisoners all over the country. And it's like in this little basement, and it's moldy and it's dark and really full of people. And we're like facing a mountain of letters of people asking for books, not barely able to fill them. And this was like one of the most joyful spaces I've ever been in. It was just this group of people who loved each other, who felt committed to the work that they were doing and committed to creating a space that was fun to be in. And that was very much dependent on this friend, Irene, and her personality and her own personal joy. Activism should be joyful. It's not that we do these things because they're fun, but that we do them because we're creating a better world where there is more joy. I feel really strongly that while you're not always going to enjoy feminism, you should be doing it because it creates a more joyful world. So that's something I try to embody in my leadership, just by sense of humor and letting that out, and not think that because something is serious, it has to be somber, but that because it's serious, it needs humor to get at the depth of it, the human depth of it.
Amen. And that's something you've done well with TED and Company too.
It also just reminds me of a story that my mother told about a friend of hers from college who, more so than my mom, became involved in the women's lib movement and literature and scholarship. And one of the things that my mother laments, because she also then looked to this friend as a leader around these kinds of issues, is that she lost her sense of humor. She had been a huge practical joker, but, you know, as time went on, the intensity of the work, it's exactly what you're saying, Allison, kind of wore her down and broke some part of her spirit so that she wasn't as resilient. That's part of the intergenerational conversation around women in leadership, because Gail's inspiring me to rethink what starts to happen to me if I'm insistent that the only way to talk about Christian feminism is in its opposition to patriarchy in the church.
And where is the yes, and what does the yes look like? We're limited by what we imagine is possible. And so it's a cultivation of the imagination so that we can then embody and act out and do things that we never thought were possible. And I think humor is a big part of that.
And imagination has a role both in resistance and in dreaming what is possible. I have a resistance story from 1969, which is when we arrived in Boston for graduate school. And this was in the great time of all sorts of no's, civil rights movement, Vietnam War, Christian feminism in its younger second wave stages. Part of wisdom, it seems to me, is discerning when it's time to say no and when it's time to focus on the yeses and the dreaming and that part of the imagination. This was a time when Mary Daly had just written The Church and the Second Sex, and people were beginning to talk about patriarchy, using the word patriarchy in a more common way of speaking, she was invited to speak at Harvard Memorial Church. And so Mary climbed up into the pulpit and began her sermon. And partway through, she began talking about the patriarchal church. She began saying, you know, we need to leave the patriarchal church. We need to walk out of the patriarchal church. Everyone here who is ready to walk out of the patriarchal church, follow me. And she climbed down from the pulpit and walked out. And then everybody was left with the choice, you know, what are we going to do? How do we work with this? This is a conservative Eastern Harvard Memorial Church. This is not your feminist gathering. It is of Mary left, and I had been sitting in on one of her classes and trying to decide what to do. I wasn't usually a real activist type anyway, personality-wise. Ted and I looked at each other and I said, I'll go. And I think he didn't know what men should do in a feminist action. It was unclear. There was not such a word as pro-feminist. And so we walked out. Oh, and one other pretty funny one was when students went to Harvey Cox's class and brought along those little party things that you blow on. Mm-hmm. And every time he would use a male pronoun for God, they would blow their little party. So imagination has its place in resistance as well.
I wanted to get into the Me Too movement and the effect of sexualized violence on women, potential leaders within our communities and our churches, and how this movement has empowered women and given people who have felt afraid to speak their truth courage. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about that impact of that movement? Even what we've been going through in Mennonite Church USA in the last how many years with the exposure and the truth about, you know, leaders and the abuse of power and sexualized violence. What do we need to do? What are we doing that we need to keep doing? What are we doing right? And where can we grow?
One of the things that from teaching the Women Men course and also Human Sexuality course at AMBS over the years that was very clear to me is that we don't know how to talk about sex. And I think that's an ongoing thing, and it's something that has to happen with every generation. We need to start young. We need to nurture strong girls and women, of course. Mm-hmm. But also, what are boundaries for both girls and boys? We need to build up a culture of respect, which we do not have in our broader culture at the moment, unfortunately, publicly. We need to support women who tell the truth. One important thing, it seemed to me, in the whole Yoder experience was once women got together and found out that they weren't unique, that this was happening more broadly, there's something empowering about that kind of increasing the courage of women to speak the truth. That's an important piece, too. I would like to say one more thing, and I don't know quite how to say it. I think that many of the men who do understand something about sexual abuse in the church are intimidated about this. So in addition to just generally we don't talk together about sex very well, mm-hmm. we don't know how to talk about this current situation where suddenly, you know, it seems like everybody is coming out of the cracks with a sexual abuse story. And somehow men need to get together and talk among themselves about how can they find ways to talk with women about this stuff.
What does it look like for Mennonite women, Mennonite men, and the Women in Leadership Project to host some conversations or consultations? I mean, you know, these are great institutional words, right? Where we do a little bit of brainstorming and storytelling. Because having inherited Gail's course, the Men and Women course, as well as the Human Sexuality course, I'll be her amen corner on that any day. We don't know how to talk about sex. Mm-hmm. And we have a difficult time articulating what we think healthy sexuality is. Mm-hmm. And how to cultivate a sense of healthy sexuality over the lifespan, from infants and young children to older adults. I think that this would be an incredible gift to the church to find ways to break down some of these dividing walls, not so that we don't have healthy boundaries, but so that the fear that surrounds these and even some of the unhelpful mystery can help us nurture the values of peacemaking and justice seeking.
Yeah, I think that fits with what we were talking about before with imagination, that I want to create a world that has more options for people, for young women. Gail, you were talking about this earlier too, that you could be a nurse or a teacher. And that was sort of it. I would like for all young people to know that when somebody approaches you in a way that you're not comfortable with, you have options. You have a lot of different tools in your toolkit for how to respond. You're not either saying yes or no solidly, one or the other, and you don't know how to say no, but you also don't know how to say yes. Like, how do people know, how do we cultivate young people who are able to explore who they are as embodied people, but not feel like it's either, oh, I am totally celibate, or I am having sexual intercourse with somebody. That there's a range of ways to express who you are and physical and emotional affection for other people. So using imagination, creating a world of more and better options.
Oh, you wise women. I have appreciated this conversation with three generations of women in leadership in Miniature 2SA. Thank you so, so much for all that you've shared today.
Thanks again to Gail, Melinda, and Allison for taking part in this conversation. It was so much fun and such an honor. I also want to thank Addy Lichty, whose original music was featured on our show today. To find more music by Addy, look for Addy and the Subtracts on Facebook or Addy Lichty on YouTube. Holding It Together is a joint production of Mennonite Church USA's Women in Leadership Project and the Mennonite Inc. Look for us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you prefer. Thanks for listening, y'all. Talk soon.